This is your Polycast for Thursday, March 23rd, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, disagreements over regulations and water quality at the Capitol and worries about Medicaid as the U.S. House votes on health care. A battle is brewing in the legislature over efforts to reform the state's environmental permitting process and delay the implementation of water quality standards. Depending on your point of view, the measures would either launch a coordinated attack on Minnesota's bedrock environmental protections or improve an unwieldy job-killing system. Dan Crocker has the story.
For nearly a decade, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has pushed legislation to streamline what they see as a slow and burdensome process for getting the go-ahead on development projects.
One of the things we hear consistently is it takes too long, it costs too much, and I'm not sure I'm going to get a permit when I get through the environmental review process.
Tony Quillis is director of environmental policy at the chamber. He says his members want to reduce that uncertainty.
At least be able to tell how long it's going to take and how much it's going to cost. Because when we can't provide those answers, people look elsewhere for economic development projects.
The chamber supports more than a dozen changes to the permitting process now followed by the Department of Natural Resources and Pollution Control Agency. Those changes have been rolled into an environment bill that passed its first legislative committee yesterday. Most are highly technical, says Aaron Clems with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, but he says taken together, they would give project developers too large a role in the process and take away the voice of citizens.
Minnesota voters did not vote to dismantle Minnesota's environmental protections. And to the extent that voters said drain the swamp, they weren't talking about wetlands. They were talking about industry lobbyists. And we hope that Minnesota's lawmakers heed that lesson.
Perhaps the most controversial proposal would eliminate the Environmental Quality Board. The EQB was created 44 years ago. It consists of 9 state agency commissioners and 5 citizen members, and it's designed to help different state agencies work together on complex environmental issues. Dave Fredrickson is Commissioner of Agriculture and Chair of the EQB. He told a state Senate committee that eliminating the EQB is a bad idea.
Passing this bill will eliminate a board that has proven to be essential to state coordination and public debate on the environment. We hear from the public that they want more opportunities to participate and engage, not less.
But Republican State Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen of Alexandria says the EQB's duties would be spread out among state agencies where the public would still have access.
I take issue with folks that think that by moving this bill forward, we're going to desecrate the state of Minnesota as far as pollution and as far as water and air. And I take issue with that, with the amount of meetings that go on and the transparency from every level.
Another proposal included in the bill would allow for an independent review of Pollution Control Agency science that affects wastewater treatment plants. Attorney Daniel Marks, who represents the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, says if cities are going to be asked to spend tens of millions of dollars on pollution controls, they want to make sure it's justified.
I think this would go a long way to enhancing credibility between rural communities and the Pollution Control Agency, improving that relationship.
The bill would also delay enforcing state water quality standards on phosphorus for 2 years. PCA Commissioner John Link Stein says many of the proposals would actually slow down environmental permitting, not speed it up.
What these provisions do across the board is bog down the process of making decisions. They extend them and they create obstacles to efficiency that we have worked diligently during the Dayton administration to streamline and make more effective.
Back in 2011, Governor Dayton supported legislation and signed an executive order designed to speed up environmental permitting. But at a news conference yesterday, he said this year's bill attempts to delay rulemaking.
This is all about thwarting the various efforts that have been made, the progress that's been made to improve the quality of our environment.
Dayton has also said he will not sign any bill that eliminates the Environmental Quality Board. Covering the environment, I'm Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Another confrontation at the Capitol is shaping up over the Minnesota buffer law designed to improve water quality. The law takes effect starting in November, but Republican lawmakers say it must be delayed and changed. Governor Dayton says that's non-negotiable. Dan Gunderson has the story.
Buffers are strips of grass and other perennial plants designed to protect water from fertilizer and soil runoff that is a significant cause of diminished water quality in Minnesota. The law scheduled to take effect this year would require 50-foot buffers on farmland along most lakes and streams. but Republican lawmakers are trying to limit the reach of the law and delay its effective date by 2 years.
This is a very, very contentious issue in rural Minnesota.
Republican Representative Dan Fabian chairs the House Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee.
Up in the Red River Valley, the area that I represent, there's a lot of angst about it.
Fabian, who's from Roseau, says several northern Minnesota counties are on record opposing the buffer law. One legislative proposal that concerns state officials and environmental groups says a landowner wouldn't need to comply with the buffer law unless 100% of the cost of establishing buffers is covered by state or federal funding. State Board of Water and Soil Resources Executive Director John Jaski says a variety of funding options are available for farmers, but full funding isn't always possible.
To make something, you know, 100% conditional on 100% financing, I think, is going quite a ways too far.
Environmental groups agree.
We believe it would be essentially a sideways repeal.
Mark Tenike works for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. He says full public funding of buffers would set agriculture apart from other land uses.
Everyone else pays. Businesses, real estate developers, municipalities, homeowners, they all foot some or all of the bill for water quality control, and we think agricultural producers should be no exception.
Another proposal would limit the streams where a 50-foot buffer is required. Tenike says that would reduce protection on thousands of miles of streams and affect more than 200,000 acres of land. John Jaski at the Board of Water and Soil Resources says many of the legislative changes are unnecessary. He says landowner and county concerns can be addressed without changing the law. Next week, the agency will release what Jaski is calling a six-pack of conservation practices that can be alternatives to a buffer in certain situations.
We expect that'll help a great deal where landowners are saying the buffer isn't going to do what it should be doing to treat water quality, but something else could do equal or better and perhaps use less of the land to do that.
One proposal everyone seems to agree on is a $10 million appropriation to help counties cover the cost of implementing the buffer law. But there is disagreement about whether that money should come from the state's Clean Water Legacy Fund or the general fund. Governor Dayton says he's already compromised by excluding private ditches from the current law. He says the law may need some tweaking after it's implemented this fall, but any changes that weaken or delay the law are unreasonable.
Buffers is not negotiable, not for discussion. I will veto any bill that has any gutting or delay in the buffer.
Representative Dan Fabian says he still hopes the governor will consider negotiating.
Because if we don't, this is going to be an explosive issue. There is going to be a significant number of farmers who are going to thumb their nose at the law, and because you didn't listen to my concerns, and because you didn't think that anything that I had to say was legitimate, I'm not going to do this.
The law says counties must decide by the end of March if they will take responsibility for implementing the buffer law or have the state step in. State officials are telling counties they don't need to make that decision until after the legislature completes its work. Covering the environment, Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
Rochester's Destination Medical Center appears poised to cross a major threshold. Later today, DMC will release a new list of construction projects that would carry the amount of private investment in the city over the goal of $200 million. If the state signs off on the list, tens of millions of state taxpayer dollars could start flowing to Rochester for infrastructure improvements. But as Catherine Richard reports, some of those private investments may raise eyebrows.
The DMC's past lists of private investment include Carol Nelson's 2014 bathroom renovation. Nelson is not a developer. She's retired. She says the $5,000 renovation had everything to do with her personal needs and nothing to do with the massive DMC effort that's transforming her downtown neighborhood.
I am elderly, and I did a walk-in shower. I had two bathrooms with bathtubs.
So Nelson says she's surprised that the city is counting her project towards a $200 million goal of private investment.
Mine wasn't that interesting renovation that it would be counted.
But the DMC has a huge incentive to count Nelson's and any other spending on upgrades towards the investment goal set by the legislature. Once that figure's reached, the state has promised $327 million to update Rochester's infrastructure over a period of many years. Several projects the DMC submitted have no direct connection to the economic development project, but the state says they count towards that goal. There's a $28,000 new air conditioning unit for a local church and a $13,000 new roof for a local business. Their leaders say the work would have been done anyway. At least three Mayo projects predate the legislature's approval of DMC funding, including a $9 million dermatology center renovation and a nearly $6 million upgrade to the sports medicine center. Mayo says expansions are done based on long-term growth projections and patient need. But an AC for a church and a retiree's bathroom aren't what some key players had in mind.
I questioned some of the projects on there.
That's former State Representative Kim Norton. The Rochester DFLer helped usher the DMC bill through the legislature. She says the requirement for $200 million in private investment was a measure to reassure lawmakers that the city would, in fact, be growing before taxpayers were on the hook. But Norton says the requirement was always framed as excluding construction that would have happened anyway.
Is this growth that's happened really as a result of DMC, or did some of these projects, were they planned and had they started anyway? And do they really rise to the level of part of the DMC growth and infrastructure?
The law on the books counts any project that occurred after July 2013 as long as it's in designated zones. And Norton says the city needs that money soon so it can keep up with Rochester's rapid growth. So far, the state has certified a total of $152 million in private investment. Mayo Clinic, the driving force behind the DMC, accounts for the vast majority of that. And bathrooms aside, the DMC is definitely attracting major investment. Blue Duck Kitchen is a new restaurant in downtown Rochester. It's located on the first floor of a once dilapidated historic building. Tracy Downs and her husband Hunter snatched up the property, and their renovations are valued at $2 million. Downs says investing in Rochester's downtown was a no-brainer.
Destination Medical Center is changing Rochester, and it's changing it in such a positive, exciting way that you want to have and be downtown. I've been coming to Rochester for 10 years, and it has not been as thriving of a place as it's been in the last few years.
The DMC is also attracting very visible and very expensive projects. A gleaming high-rise office building contributed more than $8 million to DMC's goal. And there's a $20 million expansion of Mayo's lab space. DMC Executive Director Lisa Clark says large projects like these will vastly outweigh the early, smaller investments as time goes on.
So we see developers from all over the world that are focused on Rochester, Minnesota, like never before. We have projects in the pipeline right now that Rochester hasn't seen before. So it is very clear that our work is coming to fruition.
City officials expect several developments over $100 million in coming years. And Mayo, which will continue to contribute the most money to Rochester's redevelopment, is expected to break ground on a new tech campus this year. Catherine Richard, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
The U.S. House is slated to vote today on the American Health Care Act, the Republicans' replacement for the Affordable Care Act. The legislation would drastically cut federal funding for Medicaid, the government program covering millions of lower-income and disabled Americans. As Mark Zedeklik reports, that prospect is worrying both policymakers and people covered under Medicaid.
In the White Bear Lake home where Melissa Stearns and her two kids live, 4-year-old Ezra is jumping on the top of his bunk bed, blissfully firing his Nerf gun at his exceedingly tolerant 14-year-old sister, Mira.
Look out, Mira. Behind you, Mira.
Ezra and Mira look happy and healthy.
You got me.
They have regular access to free health care because they're covered under Medicaid. They are among the roughly 1 million Minnesotans enrolled in Medicaid. Their mom, Melissa, is 38 years old, single, and earns $32,000 as a part-time church youth director. Melissa is on Minnesota Care, which is a heavily subsidized insurance program with modest out-of-pocket costs. The family is eligible for the subsidized coverage because of Melissa's income.
I notice the lights are not on in here. Is that the same money?
Yes. I'm so frugal when it comes to lights.
Melissa says she could not afford conventional health insurance for her family.
I live paycheck to paycheck. Everything is so budgeted. So I keep the lights off. The TV goes off instantly if we leave the room. We keep the heat very low. I only turned it up because you guys were coming.
Melissa Stern says it's unsettling to think about what might happen to their health coverage.
I'm really worried about it. I mean, I don't like to think of myself as not having insurance, but I can deal with it. But my children shouldn't have to deal with it. My friends that have chronically ill children shouldn't have to be stressed out.
It's not entirely clear what would happen to her family's health coverage if the current GOP plan becomes law. But the Congressional Budget Office says federal funding for Medicaid would drop by $880 billion over a decade. Minnesota 2nd District Republican Congressman Jason Lewis made the case for cuts in a video he emailed constituents last week.
You know, when President Obama expanded Medicaid, the federal government offered 90% of the cost to those states that would enroll able-bodied adults, many of them without children. Our plan says in order to preserve Medicaid for the truly vulnerable, kids, elderly, disabled, we've got to reform this.
The GOP bill upends long-standing Medicaid policy. States and the feds share the financial load of paying for Medicaid coverage. There's no limit on how much money the federal government will shell out. But the GOP bill will impose a limit. The legislation would eventually do away with the expansion of Medicaid, which provided coverage for single adults, and would eliminate MinnesotaCare, which covers Melissa Stearns. Minnesota Department of Human Services Commissioner Emily Piper says the legislation would strip billions of dollars from Minnesota.
By 2021, so within the first 18 months of implementation, the state would have reduced funding by about $2.5 billion. And that grows over time.
Piper says several provisions cause the gap to grow. Federal funding for people covered under the Medicaid expansion would shrink over time. The formula limiting each state's share of federal funding wouldn't keep up with medical inflation. Costs would grow faster than federal dollars. And Piper says the formula puts Minnesota at a disadvantage to other states. It's based on past spending, and Minnesota has been a leader in cutting Medicaid costs. Combine all of the cuts, and Piper says Minnesota would lose $5.5 billion federal Medicaid dollars over a decade. That's money, she says, that would be extremely difficult for the state to replace.
States all across the country are going to really grapple with these really hard decisions about cutting benefits, cutting access, cutting care.
Piper says elderly and disabled Medicaid recipients are most vulnerable to Medicaid funding cuts. They account for 60% of spending, even though they're only 20% of Minnesota's Medicaid population. House Republicans recently amended their bill, setting aside more money for elderly and disabled people on Medicaid. Medicaid pays 40% of the cost of long-term care in the U.S. Piper warns if cuts have to be made to long-term care for the elderly, Minnesotans who are not old will likely be picking up the tab.
Without Medicaid paying that, it's going to be a burden that falls on families all across the state to provide care and funding and resources for those aging parents.
Piper also says reducing health insurance benefits or taking them away from Medicaid recipients would likely lead to more uncompensated care at emergency rooms and hospitals, costs which would be passed along to everyone else. 63-year-old Jan Hain lives just north of Stillwater and is enrolled in Medicaid. She volunteers at a hospital and for an organization that promotes the importance of dads in kids' lives. She, too, finds the debate about cutting Medicaid disturbing.
They're playing with people's lives.
Hain says her only income comes from Social Security, about $1,300 a month. And she's worried the state may have no choice but to pass on Medicaid cuts to people like her.
I could have more out-of-pocket costs. All my co-pays could increase.
Another provision of the House bill could require Hain to find a job. It gives states the option to impose work or job training requirements for able-bodied Medicaid recipients. DHS Commissioner Piper says many people covered through Medicaid already work if they're able. And she says tracking recipients' work status would be an administrative burden.
I got it.
Back in White Bear Lake at the home of Melissa Stearns and her children Ezra and Mira.
Put down your gun.
Never.
The single mom on a tight budget is bracing for cuts and the possibility she could lose benefits.
I hope it doesn't happen. I like to be a little optimistic and think no way, but our last 6 months have shown that, yeah, it could very well happen, and it's a really scary thought.
As alarmed as state officials are about losing billions of dollars in federal Medicaid money, they caution that even if the legislation manages to make it through the House, the debate is far from over. Covering healthcare, I'm Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News, White Bear Lake.
And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.